Welcome. You are listening to WOB Radio. And going around the table, why don't you start with your introduction?
Sure. My name is fellow worker Noah. I am a member of the Tacoma IWW branch, and the Tacoma IWW branch produces WOB Radio. I also happen to be the branch secretary and also a delegate as well. So if you're interested in joining the union, if you reach out to us on our Instagram or Facebook pages, you'll get connected with one of us and we can show you how the union works. I'll pass it off to you, fellow worker.
Hello, listeners and fellow workers. My name is Gordon. I live in Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch, or GMB, of the Industrial Workers of the World. I'm a retired shipyard worker. I spent 30 years on the waterfront repairing Navy ships. I've been a machinist union member in the past and a steward. I serve now pretty much only on the WOB Radio Committee, but I encourage others to join the union and to get involved. And I'm going to pass off to my right to fellow worker Lynn.
Hi, welcome to WOB Radio, and there's a missing step here that I need to fill in. IWW is, and now we have WOB Radio, but the step in between is that the IWW people have been called Wobblies, so therefore WOB Radio. I had to get that out.
No, you're fine.
Anyway, I'm a proud member of the local IWW Tacoma branch, and I enjoy WOB Radio, and we will have a little song for you in a little bit. And please listen to us, Labor News.
I'm fellow worker Eric. I live in Auburn, and I've happily been a Wobbly for about 2 months now, and glad to be here.
And we roped you into this, didn't we?
Thankful for it.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. My name is Marilyn, and I'm a member of the IWW in Tacoma here, participant in WOB Radio, and Truth in Broadcasting here. I'm also president of the KTAH station.
I'm going to be reading the preamble to the Constitution of the Industrial Workers of the World. And that's pretty much our founding document. So, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands make the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one, an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. Knowing, therefore, that such an organization is absolutely necessary for emancipation, we unite under the following set of guiding principles and rules. And after that, that's the Constitution. But the preamble is our sort of our mission statement.
If you know this song, feel free to hum or sing along. It's step by step. And in my little red songbook, it's on page 52.
Step by step, the longest march can be won. Can be one.
Many stones can the Lord Glenon, San Glenon. Many stones can form me will, can be accomplished still. And by yonder what we will, then can be accomplished still. Drops of water along a march, singly one, singly one. Stay my stones the longest march, singly none, singly none. Many stones can form a will, singly
can be accomplished still.
And by your twirling will, yet can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none.
Our first article of labor news for our listeners today. I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with the striking machinists who are working for Boeing, or currently on the picket line outside of Boeing, if I should say so myself. This is coming out of the Seattle Times, and this was published just yesterday on the 1st. Boeing CEO delivered ultimatum to machinists. Union leaders believe him. I don't know how. So the new Boeing CEO, whose name is Kelly Ortberg, this week intervened directly in the negotiations with the machinists and personally delivered a tough message. If striking union members on Monday reject the company's latest offer, the next contract proposal will be less generous, with potentially serious consequences for the future. We can't just keep giving more, was Ortberg's position. Machinist union leader John Holden said Friday in an interview, the next offer will be regressive. While Boeing did not specify what would be taken away from Thursday's offer if it were to fail, Holden said that it can mean cutting any number of gains, including canceling a commitment to build the next airplane in the Puget Sound region, backing away from a 38% wage increase, or losing a 1% decrease in healthcare costs. They said there's anything on the table, said Holden, the president of Machinists Union District 731. They are looking at other options. Thank you for that correction. I believe that the article stated it incorrectly. It's District 751.
Correct.
So the machinists have been on strike since September 13th, and they are still holding up the picket line. This is going into, this is their second month of striking. Boeing has suffered significantly financially from this. From another article that I recently read, I believe they've lost about $9 billion because of the strike alone. A lot of the people who are part of the machinists union, they were initially striking for the goal of a 40% wage increase over, I believe it was 4 years, as well as the return of pensions, which is critical. Because pensions are something over the past several decades that have become rarer and rarer as companies have become greedier and greedier and replace them with 401k plans that employees also have to pay into. Mm-hmm. So from all the news that I've heard, the Boeing machinists are still sticking it out on the picket line. They're still very firm about their demands, and they're still very firm in the fact that Boeing can give them what they're asking for if they come to the bargaining table in good faith. So that's an update from them. Any thoughts?
Oh, lots of thoughts. So first of all, Boeing's financial troubles are also from their lax oversight and security.
Yes.
And quality control.
That's what I was trying to find, the quality control. That's a huge part of it. The CEOs are paid an obscene amount of money. They could definitely share the wealth with the workers. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to blame the workers for their own mismanagement. And I think that's obscene.
This harkens to the principle that capitalism, in its present form, cannot support the working class. That's why in our preamble we say, it sounds kind of harsh, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. Well, of course, we have parents and we have dogs and cats and... You know, we have some things in common. What we're speaking about is economically. And the Boeing machinists, there are other machinists in the state. I was in a different district for 30 years. But there are other machinists in the state. But Boeing has been traditionally pretty conservative. They don't often go out on strike. They don't often have to threaten that. But the current ethos of capitalism is such that any advantages to the working class are considered anathema and bad for investment.
Or a vice, if in another word. I've heard it described as that as well. So
I think the Boeing CEOs are also figuring this. There's an economic slowdown right now. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking they have the upper hand when it comes to employment and that workers have to put up with just everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think they are badly mistaken.
Absolutely. I mean, the major companies in this country, like the Fortune 500 companies that employ the most Americans in America, like, they have been making great money, huge net profits, hand over fist, pretty much since COVID. And even after that very brief economic downturn, they've bounced back. And, you know, a lot of people, especially in the political world, are saying, oh, well, it's Bidenomics. It's the recovery of the economy. It's the quote-unquote end of the COVID crisis and quote-unquote back to normal. But what's actually happening is that these companies have been engaging in price gouging, depriving workers of a living wage, cutting their benefits. In some industries such as meatpacking, mining, agriculture, they're hiring either recently immigrated workers or workers who are undocumented in order to cut labor costs because mm-hmm. a lot of them either don't have the education yet on how to organize their workplaces, or because in the case of undocumented workers, they aren't legally allowed to organize. Yes, fellow worker?
And in the Midwest, they're hiring children again, which is always a great sign.
Yes.
Yeah, the return of child labor. Ugh. I mean, kids love Minecraft. I don't think that they literally yearn to return to the mines. I think that one is definitely better than the other. Just to give a brief credit, the Seattle Times article was written by Dominic Gates and Lauren Rosenblatt. I also have an article here from The Stand, which is a fantastic pro-worker newsletter out of the Pacific Northwest that also reflects a lot of the same information from the previous article, basically saying that the IAM endorsed the Boeing offer. Fellow worker Gordon?
The Stand is a publication online, and you can Google The Stand and you'll get there. That is the Washington State Central Labor Council. It's their publication. So that's AFL-CIO group, but we stand in solidarity with labor everywhere. So.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is again talking about a recent contract proposal by Boeing to the union machinists, and even a lot of the union leadership are hoping that they'll take it. Fellow worker Gordon, you have an article to report on?
This is to expand on the article that you are reporting on.
Is that one from The Stand?
No, this one is from the website Portside, which is an aggregating website. And the article was written by David Discard Kallick and Daniel Costa and published in These Times magazine, another great publication for working class interests. And the title is, Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants would be a nightmare for workers and the economy. And what I'm trying to get at to amplify on the Boeing machinist strike is that when these employers hire foreign workers and pay them less wages, they're biting their own tongue. Talk about not voting in your self-interest. These guys depend upon low-wage labor. That's their ethos. Whether they have to pay the Boeing machinists more or less, it doesn't matter. It follows the ethos of cutting corners. And the only motivation for that is to maximize shareholder value. And so this is what makes it a regressive and counter-revolutionary philosophy. And what the article basically enumerates is all the ways that deporting millions of supposedly illegal immigrants, and these guys are talking even legal immigrants or people who have been naturalized. So that means, you know, like parts of my family would have to be deported, you know, back to Korea. So that would, you know, that's completely regressive and completely fascistic, in my opinion. Check out the article to get the numbers, the dollars and cents and percentages and all the arguments against mass deportations. You'll hear even many progressive Democrats say, well, yeah, we got to tighten up border security and we got to do this and that, because they're on the side of capitalism too. They're just a less nasty version of the Republicans, in my opinion. And of course, you know, anybody but Trump would probably, I could probably, you know, put my cat up for election and and she would probably do a better job of administrating and not destroying democracy. Sure. But that's just my opinion. If you want to check it out, go to Portside and look up, they have a subcategory, Portside Labor, and they'll give you all the facts and all, you know, the dollars and cents so that you can make your own decision about any kind of plan to deport all these people. Not to mention, you know, the horrible anti-humanitarian effort and splitting families up, and who the hell are they to say who gets deported?
As a matter of fact, we've already seen a small-scale case of this in the state of Florida last year, back when, what's that butt-face's name again? The governor.
DeSantis,
thank you. DeSantis basically, I believe that they passed a statewide law basically saying only legal immigrants can work in the state of Florida. Everybody else, they have to be laid off, they have to be reported to immigration services. And what happened was hundreds of thousands of workers packed their bags and said, we're not doing these jobs anymore. We're going next door to the next state that will take us.
That's right.
Construction almost ground to a halt. A bunch of manufacturing.
Agricultural
work. It killed a good chunk of their economy.
Well, don't you know there's a master plan? If they dumb down all of the schools to the point where they graduate, high school graduates that don't know anything about history or anything, they'll have a ready-made, low-paid workforce.
Yeah, yes. Several years ago, they did that in Georgia, and parents had to get their kids into school somewhere else, so like lots and lots and lots of immigrants or migrants left Georgia, and the peaches rotted.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, you know, their timing was good.
I wanted to report on just one more news article, because this just happened, and then we will move on to the next section of our show. But recently, outside of St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tacoma, Washington, there was a big informational picket that had a lot of people turn up to it. Again, this is an article from thestand.org. It's titled, Fighting for Safety at St. Joseph Medical Center. Nurses represented by the Washington State Nurses Association kicked off an informational picket this morning outside of St. Joseph Medical Center, that's on the 1st of November, in Tacoma. Currently bargaining for a fair contract, the nurses are calling attention to management's lack of response to key demands around safe staffing and workplace violence. The 1,200 registered nurses at St. Joseph will have held 10 bargaining sessions since August 21st. It is broadly recognized that the pandemic pushed healthcare workers to the limit. To ensure quality care and to protect from burnout, nurses are asking for evidence-based ratios for the number of nurses to patients. Per the union, management has increased the number of trauma cases seen at the hospital by 100%, yet is proposing cutting certified nursing assistants, CNAs, that make nurses' work possible.
Wow.
Once again, they're just looking at bean counter stuff. They're looking, where can we save money? And the motivation to maximize shareholder value and obscene salaries. So they're looking at it like an engineer would look at building a bridge. You know, and so, we can take this away, we can add this. But their whole motivation is profit. And it's not service to their patients, and it's not service to the community.
Absolutely.
And to their workers.
I live with a couple of nurses who were nurses through the pandemic, both in the ICU,
wow.
And they have definitely told me over the years that staffing ratios is one of those things in hospitals. It's not just a matter of life and death. It's also a matter of workplace safety and the ability of workers there to actually get good jobs done with a good result. You know, if you have one nurse to like three patients, maybe four patients, that's kind of the typical goal ratio. If it starts to go into 5, 6, 7, etc., especially if you're cutting CNAs who are supposed to be there to help you do your job, it becomes a nightmare. It becomes a situation where somebody's healthcare is going to be essentially deprived because a hospital management decided that the nurses who are supposed to be caring for you aren't going to be as available. And it's a really, really tragic situation that's been going on in a lot of hospitals. The Washington State Nurses Association reports that on the cardiovascular intensive care unit alone, four nurses quit in the last week. "We are critically short every day," says Yuna Flenord, a nurse on the cardiovascular intensive care unit. "At what point do we get a reprieve? Moreover, the hospital no longer has travel nurses, but did not hire nurses into these positions. Per the union, nurses are told to make it work. Already a strain, the hospital's proposal to cut CNAs makes the job untenable. CNAs are the hands of nurses, giving water to patients, responding to their concerns, monitoring their vitals. Together, the nurses and the CNAs are providers of essential care to patients at the hospital."
They should increase the number of CNAs. They should have more of those than nurses.
Yes.
If you're old enough, you will remember the phrase, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore."
And also, St. Joseph is a major cardiac specialty center.
It's a trauma hospital.
So it's very much of a magnet place for heart issues, and so it's important that those be rightly staffed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, fellow worker.
Just as a personal observation, years ago I had a pretty serious industrial accident in the shipyard. And eventually ended up at Harborview Hospital because it's a major trauma center, and we didn't have one in Bremerton at the time. I was all messed up, fell off a pier, hit the rocks.
Oh.
Never mind. My personal observation is that as far as the care you get in any kind of hospital setting, look at it, it doesn't go from the top down. The surgeons couldn't care less about you, really. You're just a chunk of meat for them. And then they hand it off to all these other people, registered nurses, physical therapists, certified nursing assistants, and down to the people who come up from the kitchen and the cafeteria to serve you your food when you're laying on your back in traction. So my fondness for the medical profession starts with CNAs and with physical therapists and the nutritionists down in the kitchen. Then you can work yourself up to the hotshot surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is a bottom-up type organization as far as quality of care. And I praised and blessed those people. Well, most of them were in my drug-addled state. You know, most of them were angelic to me. That's how it felt.
Just to close off the article here, the other issue that they're facing besides safe staffing at St. Joseph's is also workplace violence, which I've also heard stories from the nurses I actually live with about this as well, combative patients.
It's something I don't even think of, because it's, it's crazy to me that there would be workplace violence against, medical workers.
Of course it happens.
Well, it's just something that they don't show that on TV, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So, coupled with dangerously short staffing, nurses at St. Joseph's face the threat of workplace violence regularly. One emergency room nurse reported multiple instances of patients with dangerous weapons in the ER, including a loaded firearm. "With regularity, weapons are being taken off patients in the ER," said nurse Matthew McGuire. "Nursing is now one of the most dangerous professions."
Jeez.
"It's been less than a year since the last time a gun was fired in the hospital. In recent incidents, McGuire reports he had to disarm patients."
That's not in the job description.
And that includes workplace violence and security outside the facility, like in the parking lot as well. So, and again, that kind of ties back to the whole staffing issue. If you don't have enough people to help you with a potentially dangerous situation, a potentially dangerous situation is going to get deadly. So, yeah. All my blessings to anybody who works in the nursing profession, by all means. I know from the people that I know that it's a very tough profession, and I hope that the St. Joseph workers get what they deserve. All right, fellow workers, today we are going to jump into a fun and interesting roundtable discussion. This is coming also out of the IWW's philosophy on labor unionism, specifically what our opinions are on union contracts. This is something that's been, in the IWW's case, very much contested. The IWW has always had the official or unofficial position in some cases that labor contracts can stifle certain forms of organizing and prevent workers from doing things like being able to go on strike. Other fellow workers feel differently. So I just wanted to open it up to the table. How do the fellow workers here, what do you think of when you think of union contracts? Go ahead, fellow worker Gordon.
Well, there's two sides to that issue. A union contract can benefit the workers in a workplace because it provides black and white protections and wage scales and grievance procedures and things like that. On the other hand, okay, a contract can rope you into a miserable situation for years without being able to, you know, violate United States labor law, which is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, that you have to, if you're a union, you have to, in the United States, and I'm pretty sure in Canada too, you have to adhere to the labor laws there, or you can get in trouble, you know, and not just you, but everybody else you're trying to organize. So my opinion about this is that the contract should not be the main goal of unionism. The main goal of unionism is solidarity and being able to express your voice in a united way. So if a contract comes out of that, well, you know, we get to put the language in the contract. But it is something to think about. Some wobblies I've known are extremely averse to having any kind of contract. And, you know, that goes all the way to the people who just, you know, strictly emphasize contracts. So it's a mixed bag. It's going to take discernment, and it's going to take, you know, unity in action to decide if you want a contract or if you don't.
That's a really good point, Gordon. And, you know, my gut reaction is if you get the ideal contract,
yeah,
then no contest. Mm-hmm. But how often do people get that? How often are unions forced to accept less than ideal conditions?
Well, as an example, I was very proud of my old union, the IAM, about them rejecting the first, what was it, first two contract offers from the employer. They said, and that with the, how shall I put it, with the blessing of their union. Their union leaders came to them and said, here's a proposal. And they said, no, this is BS. We don't like it. And they did that twice. And that is an example of worker power and also being politically savvy. Because if you try to push for the whole bucket of cash, you maybe get the plant shut down. This has happened. They've shut down steel mills. They've shut down auto plants from the workers trying to bite off too much too soon. But the main goal is solidarity, and the main goal is communication with your fellow workers.
There's actually a great article about this particular topic up on the Industrial Worker, which for our fellow listeners, the Industrial Worker is the main outwardly facing publication of the IWW out of Chicago. And this article is titled Contracts Are Not Class Struggle. It was written by Jay Betancourt. And I did want to kind of lead off my part of the argument with a quote from this article. And I quote, these laws explicitly lay out their purposes and goals in the opening clauses. For example, the National Labor Relations Act, which forms the legal basis for most union organizing today, is officially titled An Act to Diminish the Causes of Labor Disputes Burdening or Obstructing Interstate and Foreign Commerce to create a National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, and for other purposes.
Oh, what are those other purposes?
Are those other purposes? I don't know. I'm speaking as the secretary of the Tacoma branch here. Personally, I'm a little bit split on this because on one hand, in any organizing campaign, and I've been involved in a bunch of organizing leads with our branch, on one hand, you really have to listen to the workers and what they want. If they think that they can fight for, as fellow worker Marilyn put it, a more ideal contract in their workplace, then by all means, I think that the union should support them if they want to go in that direction. However, the IWW's broader opinion, or at least in its philosophy about labor unionism, really touches on the idea of solidarity unionism.
That's what Gordon just said.
Right. And so the whole concept of solidarity unionism is you should constantly be acting in concert with your other coworkers to push for the demands or the things that you need in order to live a comfortable life and have a comfortable workplace, whether that's a living wage, benefits, etc.
Well, I've heard an expression in the union that even if you don't have a union, act like you got one. And that is worker solidarity. In other words, nobody can stop you from meeting at the bowling alley or wherever after work and talking over your problems and your grievances and your goals. Nobody can stop you from doing that. And so if you act like you already have a union, that gets the employer's notice, believe me.
And I think just to provide a bit of legal background on this as well, because I can assure our fellow listeners that labor law is a rabbit hole that is both very interesting and also very deep. A lot of unions, pretty much all the major trade unions in this country, they push for contracts because first and foremost, it creates conditions of essentially peace. You go from workers struggling in their workplace for better wages, hours, conditions, etc., and it sets in a legally defendable piece of paper. This is what we're going to afford our workers. This is how the union is going to back that. This is what rights we're going to give to management. And in many cases, a lot of these contracts also stipulate when workers can go on strike. Typically, in a trade union contract, you're only allowed to go on strike if the contract has expired or if bargaining has broken down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where, and the IWW, as a labor union, obviously recognizes the limitations of this. First and foremost, managers' rights, what the heck are those? You know, the right to fire your coworkers under certain circumstances that tend to be pretty broad. But especially the restriction on striking is also where the IWW comes into conflict with these kinds of contracts, because we know historically and here in the present that strikes are one of the most powerful weapons workers can have. To deprive your employer of your labor that you are selling for a wage in order to get more in return for your labor. And so, you know, we've seen situations like with the railroad workers about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, where they wanted to go on strike, but then the law stepped in and said, no, 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 that's going to disrupt commerce too much.
Incidentally, two more railroad workers got killed within the last 2 months.
That's terrible.
Which, again, only drives forward the point that a lot of these labor laws are crafted to protect, quote-unquote, the economy,
right,
people's right to make money off of the workers, rather than actual things like workplace safety, for
example. Remember during COVID, the essential workers, right? So they were essentially worked to death. And then after COVID was over, what did they gain?
Nothing, actually.
Yeah.
Worse, actually, considering how bad inflation and by and large price gouging has gotten.
I saw those air quotes, fellow worker Noah, when you said inflation.
Yes, yeah, inflation. I mean, yes, there is actual economic inflation going on, but again, the bigger point is the deprivation of living wages and price gouging by major companies in order to make more profit. So,
and consolidation of those giant corporations, which drives inflation.
Exactly. I think also to kind of throw in another idea in this conversation, a lot of IWW members, at least in our branch, also happen to be dual carders, so they might have a different union representing them in their workplace. I am personally of the opinion that even if you have a trade union in the workplace, first and foremost, any union in your workplace is better than none. I think we can all agree on that.
I don't.
Go on.
Okay. There are some unions that are so bad, and the contracts are so bad, that they're worse than nothing, because they keep people from doing the work they need to do to get the benefits they deserve.
This is very true, Marilyn, but on the other hand, you have closed shop. That's part of the labor law thing. So that if you work in certain, I would say, you know, many, many industries, you've got to join the union whether you want to or not.
Right.
And that creates a backlash, anti-union sentiment in the workplace. Because they say all this goddamn union does is take my money and we don't get anything. And a lot of times that's true. And you can have a union that is mobbed up locally. You can have, you know, criminal corruption, these kind of things that can turn people off to unionizing. So if you have to belong to a union because your workplace demands it, just please be aware that you can also join the IWW. That's why we call it a dual card. So one union you have to join, the other union you join by choice, and it's a solidarity union.
Good point.
And the point that I wanted to bring up was that whether or not if you have a trade union already representing you in the workplace, and even if it's a bad union, or if it's a union where it's a closed shop and you have to join, if you are a dual carder in the IWW, this is something that I personally suggest, get involved in that union anyway.
Yeah.
If there's a contract negotiation coming up, figure out how to be on the bargaining team or to provide input to the bargaining team.
And
talk to your coworkers.
If anything else, you can see how the current de facto structure works. You can see, because when I went to union meetings in Bremerton, it was like pro forma. Mm-hmm. They didn't expect me to show up. You know, they were a little weirded out that I did show up. And it was like, okay, old business, new business, whereas, pound the table, and everything was done in a very undemocratic way.
Formulaic.
So, pardon me?
Formulaically.
Formulaically, indeed.
And decisions were probably made before you ever showed up at the meeting.
Exactly, because they have an executive council, too. Now, I worked for the Federal Shipyard, the Navy Yard in Bremerton, so we were proscribed from any kind of striking. That's part of the Hatch Act, which is understandable. But still, even though we couldn't go on strike and withhold our labor legally, we still had some influence, especially in the world of occupational safety and health. You know, we couldn't negotiate for more wages. We couldn't negotiate for better coverage. But I have to tell you, when you work for a government shop, they have to follow the rules. They can't cut corners. They're, you know, told by the law that they have to do it this way. So, strangely enough, you have better EEO, you have better human relations, you have better workplace safety, you know.
Could you define EEO?
Oh, Equal Employment Opportunity. That those are programs in many workplaces, although they're disappearing, that provide protection for minorities, whether you're, you know.
But Gordon, could you still just work to rule?
Yes, indeed, you could. As a matter of fact, we did. Because I also work nuclear power. And nuclear power, you must follow a procedure.
Absolutely.
And it literally, you have people watching you from above on a balcony, and they are making tick marks on a paper.
So for the listener that may not understand what work to rule is, why don't you explain that briefly?
Working to rule means you apply every workplace rule that they give you. These are the rules. You can't do this. You can't do that. Well, guess what? If you have to check every railroad car, every axle on that railroad car, that can take a long time.
So and it's a form of work slowdown.
It's a form of slowdown, but it's working to rule. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful tactic because I'm only following the rules, boss. You know, what do you want me to do? I can't go any faster, you know, and that just blows the tops off of some managers. But we would have to do it because sometimes we were being pushed, right? And because it's not even a production goal because there's no profit motive in a federal shipyard, right? But it's like, who's got the more feathers in their cap? I made my boys and girls work faster and harder, right? And that's kind of the ethos.
And the reason why this is so effective at essentially creating a legal workplace slowdown is because intentional workplace slowdowns in current labor law are not looked upon very kindly. If you were to do a sit-down strike, that's illegal since 1948, I believe.
Yeah,
because
since Taft-Hartley.
Thank you. But working to rule still allows you to do a slowdown because you are within the bounds of labor law and you're within the bounds of what your managers expect out of you. So in a very sneaky and very effective way, you can do a workplace slowdown because, as fellow worker Gordon has highlighted, you're just following the rules.
That's right. Speed limit says 55 miles an hour. Boss, I can't go faster than that. Get this truckload of, you know, frozen pork bellies to the distributor. I've got to slow down to 55, where everybody knows you can go 60, 65, depending on where the cops are, right?
Or as long as it's not raining, yeah. But I think on another point of contracts, and this is kind of going back to if you're a dual carder and you already have a trade union in the workplace, I still encourage people to get involved because not only can you help what contracts do get ratified by the workers, but in the case of trade unions that might not be especially receptive to the people they're supposed to be representing, you can help start the change to make it more democratic, more accessible, have more decisions actually be made by the rank and file rather than just taken over as part of the officer's duties.
So basically, rather than just sit and gross about it, if you put the energy into doing some of the preliminary work, you may have some success.
Yes. And I think that, and I know this is a bit of a, I know that this is a bit of a hot button issue right now, but I think that one of the unions that really did this effectively at one point was the Teamsters. They had Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which wanted to do a bunch of these internal reforms to make the rank and file more empowered in their union decisions. And I think that, for a large part, speaking as somebody who's also a dual carder and a Teamster, that has worked out in a great number of ways. Membership has access to more information and more access to decision-making within the union, even if that has kind of fallen apart in certain places. I think that those kinds of internal reform organizations, especially if they're being led by a, you know, red card wobbly, can probably help out a lot of those trade unions in the meantime.
Well, and I'm thinking right now of the Railroad Workers United, which was an alternative union that came up that was run democratically, is run democratically.
Right, and I mean, there's also the UE union, United Electricians.
Yeah,
that's also another independent union that's also very democratic and very vocal about workers' rights and stuff like that.
And notably, not an AFL-CIO affiliate.
Yes.
They were booted out of the AFL-CIO in 1954 during the big merge and purge, where all these CIO unions, some of which had socialist, communist, and anarchist leadership, they got decertified. Mm-hmm. And that was part of that deal. But UE, United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers, I think it is, they decided, screw that. We're not going to affiliate with you guys. We're going to maintain an independent union. And they did, and that was like 60 years ago. So they're still going strong, and they're still very progressive politically.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Interesting to know.
Interestingly enough, speaking of the AFL-CIO, it also reminds me of the Vermont State Council of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, they went kind of rogue a little bit.
Well, they're definitely pretty rogue. But the reason why they're considered rogue is because they really wanted to take the democratic aspects of unionism to heart. That, like, no, the rank and file should actually be the people leading the organizing, leading the union itself. And so I think that in looking in both the Teamsters example and UE and the Vermont AFL-CIO, you see these opportunities where the trade unions have stagnated to a considerable degree in their ability to uphold their end of the bargain, and the rank and file are finally going, you know what, actually we do have power and we do have the capacity to change that. Almost similar to how a union has the capacity to change your workplace and the rest of your life, frankly. So, I mean, kind of tying things back to contracts, I think that it's very important that regardless of the union that you have, even if it is an IWW union, if you're going to settle for a contract, try to push for the most of what you can get out of it. Try to encourage the rank and file workers at your workplace to realize that the company can't afford a lot of what you're demanding. You just need to stand firm on it and be strong in your bargaining tactics and in the strategy in which you approach it. And if you're in a, say, IWW union and you're not striving for a contract, then look for other opportunities and other ways in order to get those kinds of wins. You know, one of our famous strategies, and something that's surprisingly even coming back to the trade unions, I wonder who gave them the idea, is, you know, marching on the boss.
Yep.
Or working to rule. These old, quote-unquote, old-timey labor tactics that are still legal and still very effective. And I think that Wobblies have an interesting opportunity there if they're already in a trade union at their work in order to pursue those kinds of strategies. Because a lot of times, union officers will just be like, well, let's just re-up the contract, give a little sprinkle of better benefits and call it good. And it's like, no, we have more opportunity here.
Another good rule of thumb to find out if your union is working for you is to look at the car that the business representative is driving. Mm-hmm. And look at his Mr. T starter kit and his gold, you know, necklaces and his bling. And you say, wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be a carpenter? Aren't you supposed to be a meat cutter? You know, where did you get all this extra money? Well, a lot of the business reps and even some stewards have never been on the shop floor. And that's why democratic selection of stewards and business reps and all these other offices is essential.
And should, and if you have a workplace contract, that should be put in the rules.
Absolutely. Definitely.
I think Lynn had something she wanted to say.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just said, could you give an example of those workplace techniques that you were just alluding to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Could it pique my interest?
Oh, no. By all means, I can do that. So marching on the boss is when you and your coworkers get together and directly confront your employer or supervisor. Full stop. It's incredibly effective. It's legal so long as you aren't actually trying to kidnap this person. And it's a very effective way of going directly to the person who's in control of your wages, hours, and conditions and saying, look, the shop is kind of crap right now. I'll edit that out. The shop isn't that great right now. A lot of the workers here want better pay, hours, conditions, etc. This is what we want in the workplace. Here's an exact list of demands. And if you don't do it by a certain point, we're going to slow down or we're going to strike.
I'd like to emphasize that this can happen as a result of just one issue. In other words, if people are on the shop floor, feel unsafe because a fire or two has broken out and they want to get a fire extinguisher and the company is not responding to written complaints, a march on the boss is pretty effective. First of all, employers don't expect it, you know, and you've plotted this outside the workplace so you're not wasting their precious time. But when you show up at the boss's office, and it could be just Joe Foreman, you know, say, hey, we really need a fire extinguisher out here. You know, this is dangerous machinery and dangerous oily rags all over the place. You know, so using the tactic of marching on the boss can be for something what you would think is vanishingly small, but actually very important. Because what comes out of that, the investment, is that suddenly you got 10 or 12 coworkers that say, yeah, we really put it to them, didn't we? You know,
and it bolsters morale.
It bolsters morale, which equates to stronger solidarity.
Absolutely. I think we've already done a good description of working to rule, so
yeah.
I feel like we've got that covered.
Thank you.
Another one that I wanted to highlight, and this is something that the trade unions don't typically do, if at all, to my knowledge. The IWW doesn't just believe in solidarity unionism, but another tactic that we have is minority unionism. Let's say you don't get enough steam in the workplace for whatever reason in order to have a full-blown union campaign, or if you've tried to execute a union campaign but for whatever reason it failed. Most major trade unions will throw in the white flag and say, we'll come back to this in a year because that's the next time that we can start legally be doing a union campaign again.
Right.
And just call it quits. Whereas the IWW says, look, you already have this body of coworkers, even if they're in the minority, that wants to see changes in the workplace. And by employing these other strategies and tactics we've been talking about, not just on this episode, but in episodes previous, you can still campaign for better wages, hours, and conditions.
Right.
Because you still have a unified body of people in the workplace who really care about it. And so you can essentially continue a union campaign, even if it's on the down low.
Some of the democracies in Europe have an interesting concept. They're parliamentary democracy. I'm thinking specifically of Great Britain, the UK. But they have this tendency to have a shadow cabinet. In other words, they're out of power. Let's say you're the Labour Party and you're out of power. But you still meet together with your experts within your union that could take on defense or take on internal security or take on agriculture. And you have a shadow cabinet that is ready to walk into place with a program already made. Same thing with, I'm gonna hazard a new expression, shadow unionism. You know, you can have a working body. If you've only got six people in your workplace that wanna be wobblies and wanna, you know, take your tactic, then you got six people. Call it a bowling team. Call it anything, you know, but it's like stay in touch, stay in communication. They can't fire all of yous. And just remember to stand in solidarity if they start picking on one or two of your fellow workers.
I think the New York jumped out of you there for a brief second. All of yous.
Well, I heard Chicago from you. So.
But yeah, no, I'm first of all, also fellow worker Gordon, shadow unionism is just a really cool phrase, and I'm going to use that from now on. I'm going to credit you, though.
Hey, it's not copyrighted.
Yeah, but no, that's a perfect example of that minority unionism, of even if you can't get a full campaign off the ground, or for whatever reason a campaign failed, you can still meet up with these people as a bowling team, or you can even still meet up in the workplace and be like, hey, we still want to push for these changes. How are we going to go about it now that we don't have an official union workplace? You can still get a lot of the changes you want. For example, you know, I'll use one of my previous employers as an example. You know, when a union campaign started and one of their retail stores got organized, the company suddenly did a bunch of changes to benefits, to the pay scale, retirement and 401ks, etc., because they were really scared of union contracts. But minority unionism can also do effectively the same thing of, if you scare your employers enough, or if you just keep petitioning and keep confronting them about the issues that you keep facing at work and saying that you're going to escalate again in the future, they will eventually budge, because like fellow worker Gordon said, they can't fire everybody who's suspected of trying to form a union in the workplace. They'll try, by all means, and that's my bit of inoculation. Employers do illegally fire people campaigns. It's dirty, and the only thing that they suffer from it is a fine if the workers report it.
If they're suddenly nice because one of their other businesses unionized, and they're suddenly giving other concessions to, I don't know, this particular Starbucks or whatever, just remember that the company giveth and the company can taketh away.
Absolutely.
Bottom line, get it in writing.
Yes. If you want to get it in writing in a contract or some other form of like notarized document, that's great. But another point I also want to stress is, even if the employer gives you what you want, and like you said, the employer giveth, the employer taketh away, this is where the solidarity aspect comes in.
Yes.
External shop stewards shop stewards and business representatives can help defend your contract when it gets violated, but the power, again, is in the rank and file. And the rank and file needs to be agitated and motivated and vigilant for whenever those demands are broken so that they can get ready to act again.
And what I really love is when one of these corporations needs to have the goodwill of the community that they're located in,
mm-hmm.
because they're susceptible to really negative feedback about what they're doing. And if you have to go to the newspapers and get the word out,
This especially applies to environmental issues. I mean, you'll find
the hospital, for goodness sake, St. Joe's.
Exactly. It serves a disadvantaged economic community, right? But also things like garbage dumps, toxic chemical plants. Where do they put these?
The Washington newspaper that told its employees that they could not make any kind of recommendation for political offices.
Oh.
And they lost over 200,000 readers because the readers were disgusted.
Oh, that was the Washington Post.
That's right.
Just recently.
That's right.
Owned by Bezos.
Yeah.
But that's also going to have a lot of boomerang effects on the people who work there.
They are leaving in droves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're right. And fellow worker Lynn brings up a very important point, which is in our organizing strategy, we have a mnemonic, an acronym, AEIOU, and the I stands for inoculate. And that means being honest with your fellow workers about what could happen. You know, if everybody's hanging around griping about a particular issue, we could get in trouble if we want to address it. So you have to be honest with people, especially people who are working two or three jobs, or they have to have this job so their kid can get, you know, medical care. You got to be honest with people, because if you get people fired, you're never going to unionize them.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know that contractless unionism definitely does have those risks as well. You know, you don't have a contract to prevent you from getting fired for being officially a part of a union. And again, this is something that the IWW stresses, is that even if you got a contract in the workplace, or even if you got a list of demands that was notarized by your employer or something, the rank and file has to know how to enforce that, whether that's if something gets violated, what form of action are they going to take, if things go really well. I also want to stress this too. Let's say you have a really good employer. I've heard this argument before. I've made personally the point to some fellow workers that there's hot shops, which are very contentious, very stressful environments where people just want to quit and get a different job instead of organizing. And then there are soft shops, and this is also one of my little personal terms. Feel free to use it if you want to take it. If you copyright it, please send me the dividends. But soft shops are workplaces that are very comfortable. They're very nice. Maybe you feel like you're getting paid well. Even if you don't have a 401k, you still feel like you're making enough to potentially retire in the future. Organize anyway. Organize for the hell of it. Because, as fellow worker Marilyn put it, the employer giveth, the employer taketh away. If there's an economic downturn, or if the business makes some stupid decisions,
or if they get bought out by somebody else.
Bingo. If any of that happens, it's the rank and file workers who are actually doing the work who are going to be the first people to suffer in that situation. And I would even go so far as to say that, and this is something that I don't think the trade unions stress enough, the point of unionism is democracy. I would even go so far as to say that better wages, hours, and conditions are just symptoms of good unionism. Like, the whole point of unionism is so that you and your fellow coworkers can stand together either to change the current conditions of your workplace, or if you have a really nice employer in a really nice workplace, to make sure that those conditions are upheld and that the workers can enforce that instead of some arbitrary manager or hedge fund investor somewhere.
Well said.
And I think that that's something that does not get said out loud enough.
So this is Marilyn, and I want to talk about something called Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. We were talking about unionism and solidarity. Well, consider this. Slavery is illegal in the United States.
Except
for people who are incarcerated. And this is something that has to change. IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is a subcommittee of our branch, was contacted by Jailhouse Lawyers Speak. And they contacted us on behalf of the other inside collectives. And they announced that in 2024, in December, they're starting a shut them down abolition campaign. And these are demonstrations dedicated to advocating to end legalized slavery and dismantle the prison industrial slave complex. They stated that they are continuing to advance the movement for abolition, but there's steps along the way. The campaign that they've started will be a virtual campaign in part, and there are calls for autonomous demonstrations outside jails and prisons. Simultaneously, they are encouraging imprisoned people across the country to halt all labor and all commissary spending for 1 week. So here's the deal. We have for-profit prisons in the United States still, and they are a continuation of slavery. Once we had the Civil War and that came to an end, there was a sop thrown to the southern states and the slaveholders. And the SOP was the exclusion of the abolition of slavery in the prisons. So it was a very convenient way for the plantation owners to have a continuous supply of free labor. Mm-hmm. And it's been continued up to now.
Yeah.
And prisoners can work for as little as a dollar a day in demeaning and unsafe conditions, where if they refuse to work, they are sometimes thrown into solitary confinement. And then, for the little money that they do get, a dollar a day, the commissary has items that they need to exist.
Soap, toothpaste, razor blades, water.
Water. Supplements to their food supply.
And a lot and of times the water that is through the pipes is very bad water.
The prices in the commissary are obscene. They are sometimes triple and quadruple what they are on the outside. And of course, the incarcerees can't go somewhere else to shop. And then if they want to use the phone to contact family or their attorneys, that's another issue. There is only one company they can go through, and the prices for phones are extremely high.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.
So what they're going to be doing in prisons all across the United States, starting December 6th and through the 13th, and I don't know how much longer, is they will be withholding their labor and their money at the commissary. And what they want people on the outside to do, and that means you, listener, and that means me, and that means the IWW, and I'll get to the other groups in a minute, we need to get the word out by being visible and by being audible. There are two separate events that are scheduled during that week of December 6th through the 13th. And I wanted to alert people as to what they were and where they will be. And then also on your own, they have asked for people to organize email and phone blasts to Congress demanding repeal of the 13th Amendment and halt funding for new prisons. Email and phone blast Congress to demand repeal of truth in sentencing. Write inside, a letter writing campaign to get the message inside to halt all work, because they're shutting down communications as much as they can within the prison. If you happen to know somebody in prison, listener, write them and let them know. Hit the concrete, and that's what we're going to be doing, and we welcome people to come and join us. We will have a demonstration at a jail and an immigration center, demonstrations at your local political businesses, demonstrations at businesses that use prison labor or support making profits off of people in prisons. So the things that so far have been planned in Tacoma here, let me pull this up on my calendar, and you can spread the word. Several other organizations have been notified about this and have endorsed it. So Climate Alliance for the South Sound has endorsed this and will help supply people to demonstrate. An umbrella organization known as Climate Alliance, no, not Climate Alliance, excuse me, Climate Catastrophe Ground Zero, which is indigenous-led and is an umbrella organization that includes Black Panthers of Tacoma, La Resistencia, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Climate Alliance for the South Sound, at least one union, and several other organizations have also endorsed this, and we'll be coming out in numbers. The dates you want to remember are on Friday, December 6th, there will be a sign-making party in preparation. It starts at 3 o'clock, and we will be meeting at 311 Puyallup Avenue, and that is 350.org Tacoma. That is their building. They've also signed on to this. And you are welcome to come down to 311 Puyallup Avenue and help with sign making. That's the first thing. Then on Monday, December 9th at 10 o'clock, we will be going to the Pierce County Prison, which is also the county city building location. And we will be demonstrating at 10 o'clock. And we will bring our signs, and hopefully we will have drumming, and we will have noise, and we will make our presence known, and we will make our concerns known.
So the Pierce County Jail?
Yeah, yeah. Then on December 13th, which happens to be a Friday, we will be going down, wait a minute, We will be going down to the Northwest Detention Center at 1623 East J Street, and at 4 o'clock, we will begin a car brigade, and we will make noise, and we will shine our lights because it'll be dark at that time. La Resistencia has contacted us and wants to know what time we're doing that, because they're planning events also that will coincide with that, probably a little before, so that they can use their loudspeaker and be heard over our horns. If we have enough people that are willing to go out there and let it be known that we need to stop prison slavery, we will also schedule more events during that week. And listener, you may be aware, I hope you're aware, that there was just another death down at the Northwest Detention Center. This has got to stop. We need to shut down that abomination, and we need to stop prison slavery. So that's what's going on in December. And do people have any questions or anything they want to ask me?
I got nothing. I think you did that really well.
Can they? Is there a website they can go to that the listeners can go to get some of this information?
Yes, thank you. Okay, the pamphlet that I read to you from, which is called Abolish Prison Slavery, Shut 'Em Down 24, you can go to www.jailhouselawyersspeak.com. Shut M down, S-H-U-T-E-M-D-O-W-N.
Go a little slower.
Okay, I'm going to go slower. W-W-W. Jailhouselawyersspeak, all one word, .com/ shut them down, all one word. And then you are welcome to go on to Facebook and contact our branch of the IWW. And do we have a website that's ever written?
Our branch does not have its own separate website. However, if you reach out to us on our Facebook page, Tacoma IWW, or our Instagram page, which is also Tacoma IWW, if you reach out in a direct message, our social media coordinator will let us know, and we can get you the information that you want.
Yeah. So listener, spread the word. Come out. We were talking about solidarity. Stand in solidarity.
Local events previous and upcoming. I know that fellow worker Gordon wanted to talk about Centralia.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect.
Okay, then I'll start talking about it. This November 11th, which is also known as Veterans Day, is the commemoration, I call it Remembrance Day, but it's a commemoration of the IWWs who got incarcerated, and one of them got lynched on the first Armistice Day in Centralia, Washington. And you can read about it. It's been called the Centralia Massacre, but we have successfully started to change that language to the Centralia Tragedy, because a group of Army veterans who shall remain nameless, the American Legion, actually raided our Union Hall in Centralia and started to bust it up. And what happened is that the IWWs defended their labor hall, and as a result, several of the Legionnaires got shot. Okay, so flash forward to 1924, and the American Legion puts up a monument right down there in George Washington Park in downtown Centralia. And it's going to be the 100th anniversary of their installation of that coming up on November 11th. So a contingent of Wobblies plans to be there too, just so we can keep the best interests of our monument in mind, and to remind people that people were murdered and incarcerated, sometimes for up to 15 years, I believe, and the lawyer for the IWW got disbarred.
For no good reason.
Well, they didn't like him. They didn't like the fact that he was defending the industrial workers of the world, which back in the day, in 1919 especially, during the Red Scare, the first Red Scare, were considered revolutionists and were considered dangerous thugs. And so, there's a lot of bias and prejudice against labor in general, and especially the IWW back in the day and also up till today. So I would encourage people to look up the Centralia tragedy and or the Centralia massacre and get a picture of what happened down there. It was an armed riot, basically, with the collusion of the local authorities. And tremendous injustice was done. Also, as well as viewing our monument, which just got installed a few months ago, viewing the monument and getting, you know, up on the history of labor, the IWW, and that horrible tragedy down there, we can also defend our monument against possible radical activity. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the more people we have there that are sympathetic to the IWW's cause, the better. And so if you're interested, please read up on it. Come on down on November 11th, and we gather every November 11th, and we visit some of the grave sites of the Wobblies who were, well, the Wobbly who was lynched and the Wobblies who were incarcerated. So it's an interesting historical trip. It also shows solidarity for the labor movement in general. I mean, we had other unions help us install that monument.
LIUNA
252, local 252, provided labor, poured concrete for the base. We had some donated labor from other outfits. So come on down, take a look at our monument. It's right in the heart of downtown Centralia. And show up and give us some support. We appreciate it.
I just wanted to give also a little brief report back for the listener as well from the previous year's visitation of the now new Centralia Monument that we have down there in downtown Centralia.
Right.
Typically, we show up in the morning down there by the Legionnaire statue, which is where our new IWW monument for the union workers who are persecuted currently is. We all gather there, we do a nice brief historical discussion, and then something that's actually new to the itinerary that I haven't seen in previous years is that now we actually have a walking tour of Centralia. So we go around to the different points in town where certain events of the Centralia tragedy took place. We cover the whole historical background of like the lead up to what happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. And then typically after we meet up and do the walking tour, then we go and we visit the graves of the Wobblies that are buried down there, including Wesley Everest. We, of course, if anyone is planning on attending this, if you show up to Centralia, we have plenty of printouts that show you a map of the area, where we're going to be going to, where the grave sites are located. And then afterwards, we typically gather down there at that train station, mm-hmm. right there, just a couple blocks down from where the IWW monument is. And we get together and we sing and we eat and we talk about what's going on in the IWW. And we just have a wonderful social hour afterwards.
Yeah.
And also a happy hour if you're interested in that kind of thing as well. I certainly enjoyed that, but Centralia is not just a pretty town, it also has a rich labor history, and the IWW is definitely a cornerstone of it.
Oh, and just an additional comment, there's a movement afoot that's just in its infant stages, but the movement is to get the names of those incarcerated Wobblies cleared. In other words, we're petitioning the governor of the state of Washington to exonerate these people, or at least pardon them posthumously. So as a matter of fact, I have personally met the daughter of one of the incarcerees. She wrote a book. She's going to be there. Her name is Esther Barnett Goffinette, and she wrote a book called Ripples of a Lie, I believe is what it's called. And so that was her dad, you know, who got incarcerated for, I forget how long, 12 years. But it really wrecked a lot of families down there, and it wrecked the reputations. Workers got blacklisted, etc. So what we're trying to do, it seems like, you know, maybe a sentimental gesture, but it also has real-world consequences. We're going to try to clear their names.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon. I really hope that that campaign takes off, because, again, a lot of these fellow workers were charged and imprisoned for defending their union hall for the second time under the guise of an Armistice Day parade. So
this will be November 11th?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can go.
Well, it's also simultaneously it's Veterans Day, but as IWW is, we look at it a little different. I happen to be both. I'm a veteran and I'm a Wobbly. but I take the attitude that
Armistice Day, not Veterans Day.
Right. Later it was changed to Veterans Day.
Well, Veterans for Peace are bringing that back. It is
really?
Armistice Day.
Well, good for them.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, last year, Veterans for Peace, I believe, was down there in Centralia with us as well. They had some banners
they
out there.
They had some people, but usually they're up in Auburn because they have a big Veterans Day parade in Auburn and basically glorify military and try to make it very attractive to young people.
Mm.
And the Veterans for Peace have historically gone up there and marched in that parade and been kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And we make a point of being up there every year. But we're going to be there on the 9th, which is when they're having their parade.
Oh, cool.
So that means on the 11th, I will be free to go down to Centralia.
Free to rabble rouse with us.
Well, as much as I can. Anyhow.
But yeah, I think that Centralia, and especially the Centralia tragedy, for me personally, it was one of those historical events that the more I did reading on it really drew me to the IWW, because I think that even though I am a college graduate, I think something that really doesn't get talked about even on a local level is labor history, which I personally find incredibly fascinating. I mean, the labor history of Washington State, especially with the IWW, is huge. I mean, we had some of the longest surviving IWW lumber locals in the state, out on the coast of Aberdeen and
Washington with mining.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And the shingle weavers in Everett, which was the Everett Massacre in 1915. 16, my apologies. But yeah, no, I think that it's one of those foundational labor history events, not just the IWW, but also Washington State. I mean, it really set the tone for what was going to come decades later. And I really encourage people to show up in Centralia on November 11th. If you need a ride, feel free to reach out to the Tacoma IWW and we'll give you a free ride.
And if you smoke, you can ride in my car.
If you vape, you can ride in mine. We're just going to have to crack the window a little bit.
It's also interesting that you noted that you're fortunate enough to be a college graduate, and many of us at the table are. I'm not, but that's beside the point. What I'm getting at is that back in the 19-teens and the 1910s, many, 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 many fellow workers were illiterate, functionally illiterate. They got their information from IWW stickers and cartoons and songs.
Oh, especially the songs.
Yes, and that's what gave us the nickname Singing Union. And it also, we were using the internet of the era. We were using boxcars to put up stickers so for the itinerant workers to see the IWW was with them in the boxcars, on the railroad tracks, in the hop fields. And so because we're no longer an illiterate class of people for the most part.
Oh, speak for yourself.
Well, you just have to put yourself in the shoes of those mostly men, but a lot of women too, who were functionally illiterate, no education, and had to follow jobs all across the country. So labor history is American history. I've heard this said about black history. It's true about labor history. It's true about Hispanic history. You know, it's American history. And because you may not have heard about it, it's still there. It's in the record books, and there's plenty of books to read about it.
Speaking of the fight for workers' rights and the fight especially for unions in this country, I also wanted to give a brief shout out to something that's currently taking place here in the South Sound, which is the Campaign for the Workers' Bill of Rights. This is something that the Tacoma IWW has just recently endorsed, as well as various other unions such as UFCW 367 here in the South Sound. This is a initiative currently building here in the city of Tacoma. And the core of what they are fighting for are wages that are closer to a living wage, opportunity for more hours before hiring new employees, predictable schedules that your family can rely on, and safe workplaces through better staffing and better training. So what the wage that they're currently fighting for as part of this Workers' Bill of Rights initiative is $20.29. That is also earmarked to rise with inflation at its current predicted rate.
I was really impressed with listening to some of the workers talk about the safety issues on the job, mm-hmm. when they scale back and there's only one person on, and what happens if there's a break-in or an assault, there's nobody to call.
To clarify, you mean like only like one person at the workplace?
Yes.
On night shifts and
yes.
things like that?
Yes.
Or only two people on a mile-long railroad train?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Things like
right.
that.
Yeah, no, I mean, worker safety is definitely something that they want to push forward as well.
Yeah.
And obviously a big part of that is better staffing so that they can respond to unsafe situations instead of some, you know, there's only one cashier at a register and someone's getting hostile at them and there's
right.
not anybody
right.
from another department that
can I can remember as a mental health worker hearing about workers at Western State Mental Hospital that were murdered because they were the only person on a floor
mm-hmm.
and there was no one there that they could call out to.
No right. panic buttons back in the
yeah,
day either.
Yeah.
No police presence.
I have a couple of things that I'd like to announce before we wind up the show.
I also just wanted to add a very brief note, though, that sometimes worker safety isn't just about hostility from customers or other coworkers. It can also mean like workplace hazards and things
of
like
course.
that they're fighting for as well.
Of course.
Fellow worker Lynn?
I used to work at Purdy Treatment Center for Women, is what it was called back then, in 1972, and it was about a year old. And anyway, there were no weapons. I wouldn't have wanted to work there if I'd have had to handle a weapon. There was an electronic board, and so I was hired in maximum security, which had no training, no experience. They gave me no self-defense training at all. All I had was this electronic thing. Well, one day I was the only person on duty, and a woman who was very paranoid and very strong came up to me and grabbed me from behind. And she wanted the keys, and there was nothing I could do. There was no way I could get to the headquarters to, you know, because she restrained me. And I really thought my life was gonna be over. Because she really thought people hated her. And I just started talking. I have no idea what I could have said to her, but I talked, and I think she got bored and just flung me away. But I mean, that should never exist.
No, it should never exist.
You had some announcements, fellow worker?
I do, but my phone went dark. Hang on a minute.
And the choking up was from the carrot, not from the story.
So, we talked a lot about solidarity today.
Mm-hmm.
And in solidarity, I'd like to announce some events that are coming up that the listener might want to be involved in. So, on November 9th at 2 o'clock, from 2 to 4, there is a workshop called Speaking Truth to Power. And it is put on at 311 Puyallup Avenue. That is the 350 Tacoma site. And people are welcome to come. The people that are putting it on are the Black Panther Party and 350. Also coming up, that's November 9th, is on November 10th from 1 to 3 at Evergreen College in Tacoma. Have you heard about something called ShotSpotter?
Yes, I have.
Okay. There will be a workshop about ShotSpotter, which is this thing that comes directly out of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli government developed this, and apparently city councils and cities across the country think this is a great idea. It's a program that is put in certain areas of town which are considered high crime. So you can figure from that already
yeah.
that it's racist as hell.
Yeah, what neighborhoods are they going to
yeah.
go to?
And if this thing picks up something that it thinks sounds like a shot, they will dispense police. Armed police.
Yeah.
So ShotSpotter has been bought hook, line, and sinker by the Tacoma City Council.
Mm-hmm.
They've signed up for it for 3 years, spending our taxpayer money. And if you want to learn more about this thing, it will be a workshop at the Evergreen State College in Tacoma, which is on 6th Avenue. And it's from 1 until 3. And it's Sunday, November 10th.
And just to give a little bit of extra context to this, as fellow worker Marilyn said, these shot spotter technologies, which are meant to detect gunshots if they occur within a certain neighborhood or just within a certain area, a lot of them, as fellow worker Marilyn said, are being put in places that are typically low income, typically have a larger proportion of minority homeowners or minority tenants, you know, quote unquote, high crime areas. And this is definitely another example of essentially broken window policing. You go to the places where crime is the most concentrated, and instead of actually improving the material conditions of that community,
exactly,
you just police it heavier.
So, yeah. No, well, and there's also the... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're quite all right. I was thinking out loud here. It's a way to just oppress and scrutinize, you know, people with...
Well, number one, it comes... It's Israeli technology. What does that tell you? And
nothing good.
Number two, do you trust your police force not
Absolutely
to
not
kill a Manny Ellis or a? It's just horrendous.
It's right. Your most recent name here.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to announce.
Okay.
And then for those who don't know, what is 350? Where people are meeting at some of these events?
Bill McKibben in the 70s wrote quite a bit about the level of carbon dioxide in the air beyond which we would have a very hard time preventing climate chaos. Now, 350 was the number he gave.
That's parts per million of
parts
CO2.
Parts per million. We are now well over 400.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I want to say.
I just wanted to explain what that meant for the people who are going to go to the headquarters for some of these events.
So that's what's going on in my little world. Does anybody else have announcements?
I would like to just give an announcement. I know that we haven't done this on the radio before, but if anyone is interested in joining the Tacoma IWW, again, you can reach out to us over Facebook or Instagram, and you can get connected with a delegate of the branch, either me, fellow worker Noah, or fellow worker Marilyn, and we can show you how dues payments works, how the IWW operates, how we can help get you started on organizing in your workplace. We also have branch meetings on the last Sunday of the month. Typically, we open the doors at 6:30 p.m. at Hilltop Solidarity, and then 7 p.m. we typically start our meetings. So if you want to get in touch with us, that's a couple of different opportunities.
And we'd love to have you join, and join us also at WOB Radio.
Please, yes. If you are a worker, if you're a retired worker, if you've been formerly incarcerated, if you work in basically any industry, you can join the IWW as long as you don't have higher firepower, as long as you aren't a landlord who makes 50% or more of their income off of the homes that you own, essentially, and if you aren't involved in police work or corrections officers.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was just wondering whether if you Googled Solidarity Spot, it would come up, and it does.
Hilltop Solidarity Spot has a Facebook page.
Okay.
That has the address on there as well.
Okay.
And that's not exclusively an IWW venue. It's a community venue, and they're kind enough to let us use their space for our meetings.
I just want to thank all of our fellow listeners who are tuning in once again. This is WOB Radio, that's W-O-B. This is a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. If you want to get organized with us, you can reach out to our Facebook or Instagram pages. And if you want to join the IWW directly, you can either go to IWW.org and get signed up through there, or you can reach out to a local branch delegate. We also want to thank our broadcasters. 101.9 KTAH, that's Radio Tacoma. 95.3 KTQA, which is also based out of Hilltop Tacoma. And our lovely broadcasters up near the Great White North, that's 94.9 KZAX. We want to thank you all for tuning in. Best of luck out there on the front lines with the rank and file, and solidarity.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.